said, I am bearing an unusual burden and speaking it on every occasion, putting the church on alert for a soon coming catastrophe. It's the catastrophe of Israel, as I am expecting, I'm looking for an appropriate word, debacle, D-E-B-A-C-L-E, a complete collapse of the present state, a probable expulsion from the land again into the nations, and triggering reaction throughout all nations where Jews are. It's called the time of Jacob's trouble. It's future and it's near. And a chief source would be Jeremiah chapters 30 and 31. Phrase is drawn, the time of Jacob's trouble. Jesus at the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, Luke 21 speaks of such a time as never was before since the world began, nor will be again. And if that time were not cut short, no flesh would survive, but for the elect's sake, that time will be cut short. I think he's speaking of the same event, and then he warns his hearers that they should flee to the mountains, or the hills of Judah, pray that it doesn't come on the Sabbath or in the winter. So there's every indication that he's talking about an event that has its inception in Jerusalem and in Israel. But it's not confined to Israel, for it's a time of Jacob's trouble, wherever Jacob is. So I'm expecting a massive sifting of Jewish people throughout the world in one last exile, one last expulsion, in which the majority of them will not survive, and a remnant returning to Zion with everlasting joy upon their heads and mourning and sighing fleeing away. That's found in Isaiah 35 and I believe also Isaiah 51. Would be unnecessary if Israel had not the destiny and calling that it does, to bless all the families of the earth, to be the center, the locus of God's theocratic kingdom and rule, because out of Zion must go forth the law and the word of the Lord out of Jerusalem. That's not poetry, that's a literal designation of God's chosen people and God's chosen location to be the center of his kingdom throughout the world. The church has been historically guilty of spiritualizing such references and thinking that Zion is a synonym for the church, but God means the literal holy hill in the city of Jerusalem. Psalm 2 speaks of it. I set my king on the holy hill of Zion and given him the nations for his inheritance. And yet the heathen rage. The nations rage and the peoples and the kings and their rulers take thought against the Lord and against his anointed to break their bands asunder. The world does not want God's kingdom to come. They would love to keep the church in a state of sleepwalk, to think that the kingdom is some kind of interior thing. The kingdom of God is within you, and that it's, which is certainly true in many ways, and to disguise or to remove the understanding of the kingdom as a very literal political rule of God over his own creation. The whole of God's salvation history culminates with the coming of the king, who has to be a descendant of David, because he can only be enthroned upon the throne of David on the hill of Zion in the city of Jerusalem, that the law might go forth out of that place and the word of the Lord to all nations. Isaiah chapter 2 speaks of it, repeated exactly word for word in Micah chapter 4 from verse 1, that the mountain of the Lord will be higher and above all the mountains and hills, and the nations will make their way unto it and come to the God of Jacob, that he might teach us his ways. So there's a destiny, a remarkable destiny that affects all nations. In fact, it was God's intention from the first that Israel should be central to all the nations of the world. And what a test for the nations and even the church in the nations who have not Israel as their preference. They would have chosen some other nation. Israel would not be their choice. Israel's track record leaves much to be desired. God doesn't mince words. You blaspheme my name in every nation where I've driven you. But that does not negate nor nullify God's call, promise, and gift and calling. The gifts and callings of God are irrevocable. He does not take them back again. He does not disqualify them. A nation doesn't have to rise to a standard in order to attain to it. He supplies the standard. That standard is the new covenant. Israel is notorious as a covenant-breaking nation. But in the end, when they come to a place of everlasting joy, not the least of the reasons for it is that he has made an everlasting covenant with them. Why everlasting? Because it shall not again be broken. Why will it not be broken? Because it does not wait upon Israel's faithfulness to keep it. He who gives it also keeps it. He writes it in their hearts and in their understanding that they will all know God. Is all this familiar? Is all this strange? Is all this uncomfortable? All this is the God who has mercy upon whom he will have mercy and chooses whom he will choose. Because the issue of God's choosing is the issue of God. So if you have any complaint, if Jews rub you the wrong way, if you have no native disposition for them, something is amiss in your relationship with God. For nothing measures that relationship more accurately than your understanding, your disposition, and your heart toward the people whom God has chosen. Now, tonight, I've been brooding a bit, that I'm in a mood, I believe, that the Lord has established appropriate to the text that I think he wants us to consider, which is Isaiah 53. As we all know, that is the greatest classic statement of the suffering servant Jesus. But you may not know that Jewish authorities and commentators, rabbis, sages have disputed the Christian interpretation of Isaiah 53 as pertaining to our Messiah, and say that no, it pertains to Israel, that Israel itself is a suffering servant and has blessed the nations through its suffering. Well, I think that if that's not been true in the past, it will be true at the end. There's a way in which, in the wisdom of God, I believe that the nation that is called to be a son, the first use of that word in Exodus chapter 4, is for Israel. In Moses' confrontation with Pharaoh, let my son go, that he might serve me. And so this, the intention of God yet remains. Israel is called to be, like its Messiah and Lord before it, also a servant son. For its call is to be a nation of priests and a light unto the world. Do you believe that? Or do you think it's needful? I would say that the lamentable condition of the world today is to a great extent the consequence of Israel's failure to fulfill that calling. Remember that one out of the 12 tribes was exclusively a priestly tribe. It had no inheritance in the land. God was its inheritance, and its function was to serve the nation and stand before God on behalf of the people, to teach the law, to teach the people the difference between the sacred and the profane. God did not think it lavish to take one of 12 tribes and give it no other function but an exclusive priestly function to mediate the reality of God to the whole of Israel. You can watch the rise and fall of history, of Israel's fortunes throughout its history, by just examining the condition of its priests. For as the priest, so also the people. So why am I saying that? Because the same principle by which God would take one of Israel's 12 tribes and give it the exclusive designation and service of a priestly kind and of a teaching kind, God intends that for the entire nation to all the nations. You better get lined up with the saints if this is God's program and design, and not oppose it, but welcome it, anticipate it. And before I finish tonight, I hope to indicate how graphically you're going to have part in this whole concluding saga. There's a certain requirement for priestly servant sons is called suffering. That should not be a novelty or an unusual thought for those of us who feel that call ourselves. And indeed, it is the call of the church to sonship, to servanthood, to priestliness, not from a racial or genealogical origin, but in the form of the Son of God and Melchizedek priesthood. And we know that Jesus learned obedience to the things that he suffered. There's a necessary suffering. There's a humiliation that precedes the exaltation that God bestows on servant sons who are honored to bear his name and his word and the revelation of himself to the nations. Israel is not in the condition to bless all the families of the earth. I don't know if you've noticed. I don't know how informed you are. I don't know if you're reading the Jerusalem Post. I don't know what information you're getting. But I can tell you that anyone who is a student of the state of Israel, has any kind of sympathy, is coming increasingly day by day to a kind of sad and melancholy sense of profound disappointment in the things that are taking place morally, ethically, in the conduct and the life of a nation whose back is forced to the wall, surrounded by enemies who are determined with to her destruction, and having within its own borders a Palestinian presence that has exactly the same intention. God is the author of Israel's predicament. And I would say that the whole state of Israel has been established by the grace of God, or by his, and I always grope for this word, not his perfect, his providence, in, not in order to succeed, but to fail, to demonstrate to Jews that they are not in themselves capable of establishing a nation state that will bless the nations of the world. It has got to be God's exclusive work. And for that reason, this self-sufficient people will be brought down into the place of death before they will be raised up to a place of resurrection and newness of life, alone by which they can fulfill the promise of God and the intention of God throughout their history. So I've started to read Isaiah 53 with a double application. One for Jesus, which is certainly and unquestionably accurate, but also with a slight substitution of the pronouns from a singular to a corporate, there'll be so much that will be suggestive of what I believe is going to happen to Israel that will be required to follow its Lord in a road to Calvary. And maybe on that road, when they taste something of the rejection and suffering which their Lord experienced before them, which they have historically rejected, it will open their understanding in a way that nothing but their own mutual experience would have fitted them to see. How are we doing so far? Catch the control tower, over. Testing. Are we okay? Yeah? And my English is clear.
sensible,
not elaborate.
Okay. You know that Isaiah 53 properly starts in Isaiah 52, where I have an italics over verse 13, the suffering servant. See, my servant shall prosper, he shall be exalted and lifted up, and shall be very high. Anyone who knows Israel's final destiny knows that that is almost as descriptive of a restored nation as it is of the Lord. It's the exaltation that follows humiliation. Nations will come to Israel, will bring their riches. Kings and queens will bear the last of Israel's exiles on their shoulders and suckle them. Ships of Tarshish will bring their wealth, their tribute, the honor. God says Israel will be a diadem in his hand. It will be a jewel. He'll call them by a new name. The city of Jerusalem will be called the city of righteousness. That nation that refuses to come up annually to the Feast of Tabernacles will suffer a curse. If it still allows its ancient anti-Jewish disposition to keep them from the recognition of a nation which God has exalted. Not because it deserves it. Not because it's a reward for services rendered. Not because it has anything to do with the merit of Israel in itself, but simply the statement of a God who lavishes on a prodigal and returning son a ring, a garment, and a feast. Now, we may have the disposition of the elder brother who's not too happy about that, who begrudges the father's lavish reception of a son who had wasted all his inheritance. But the father said, "Son," speaking to the elder, "this is one who has come back from the dead. Why don't you rejoice and enter the party?" Why couldn't he? What was in his heart that was not like the father? Why was he envious and jealous? What kept him from enjoying the return of the prodigal brother? There's something in the heart of the church for whom that parable is intended. And you know what I can say about that? There's nothing that searches the heart of the church and reveals the truth of its condition than the subject of Israel itself, rightly considered. And I hope you understand, when I keep referring to Israel, I do not mean the present political state. I'm talking about the nation, not the state. The state is, God is not under obligation to preserve this political entity. It was an expedient, a provision, to set in motion the things that must necessarily take place in the Middle East and in Jerusalem, that sets Israel on its road to Calvary. But when I talk about Israel, I'm talking about that people that God said will never be abolished so long as the sun gives its light and the moon holds its course and the stars. They are established before him forever. Deuteronomy 32:8 says that when God established the numbers of the nations, he did so in terms of the sons of Israel. I've never heard anyone preach that text. This one allusion to the significance of Israel with reference to all nations. And there'll never be peace for all nations until Israel is fitted in to the schema of God, where nations will bow and be broken in their arrogance and opposition to God by their surrender to the center that he has established in that nation and with that people. Now, I suppose you think I'm saying all this because I'm Jewish. No. I've been Jewish for 71 years, and I'm only holding these views for the last 10, 12, 15 years by the grace of revelation and understanding given me. If God had chosen pygmies, I would be celebrating pygmies tonight as God's chosen people and as the epicenter of his whole mode of coordinating the nations in submission unto himself. God is going to rule from the throne of David. from the holy hill of Zion. Eat your heart out. You know, what can I do to accommodate you? You may be as tough as my Anglo-Saxon audiences if your background is Dutch or German. That's Aryan, Anglo-Saxon. You don't know how deep it is. You don't know. And I just stumbled across an article in a Christian magazine on the history of Jews in South Africa, and there is a remarkable history of anti-Semitism. And according to the article, I'm just a newcomer to the subject here, it says that the Afrikaners were more disposed to have a bitterness toward the Jew than the English. In fact, the Afrikaners thought that the Jew was part of the English design to subvert their South Africa. Whatever it is, you need to search your heart. Because I believe that this people on their road to Calvary will be coming right through Bindura, Zimbabwe. God is going to shift them through all nations because their ultimate destiny is to all nations. But in sifting them, by uprooting them and moving them through the nations in a state of chastisement described in Isaiah 53, he also sifts the nation itself and the church within the nation. How do you know, Bob? Because Matthew 25 persuades me that God's first judgment, when he is seated as king, after the restoration of a remnant who returned to Zion with everlasting joy upon their heads, mourning and sighing fleeing away, sifts the sheep from the goats throughout the nations on one question only: what did you do with the least of these, my brethren? Well, if that's true, according to Amos 9, that you will sift this nation through all nations and not allow one kernel to fall to the ground. If it's true, according to Ezekiel 20, that it's through the wilderness of the nations that they are to be sifted, not the great urban centers of Johannesburg, where Jews like to have their affluence and dwelling, but the out-of-the-way places they would not have chosen. What makes you think that Bindura, Zimbabwe, is one of those places? Just my presence tonight. That's all. And because your location has all the earmarks appropriate to their being sifted, brought down dirt roads and dark areas that are not illumined, and tracking through places where a Jew would never have thought to set his foot. So what will you do when they come upon you in their untaught condition, suddenly uprooted and totally disconcerted and agitated and confused and wondering how again in the same century there could be yet another Holocaust, global, worldwide? Are you prepared to take them in? Will you take them in? Or will you say, Lord, Lord, when did I see you naked, thirsty, hungry, and in prison? Only to answer, if you did not do this for the least of these, my brethren, you did it not unto me. And I tell you, saints, they are going to become the least. Do you know why? Because they're going to become the most. Because they've got to go all the way down in the most profound humiliation, like the Lord before them, in order to be exalted in a place above all nations, without it affecting their ego and giving them a sense of superiority over Gentile nations by which they would lord it over them rather than serve them in a priestly humility. So verse 14 of Isaiah 52, just as there were many who were astonished at him, or let me say, astonished at them, so marred was their appearance beyond human resemblance, and their form beyond that of mortals. So shall they startle many nations, and kings shall shut their mouths because of them, for that which had not been told them they shall see, and that which they had not heard they shall contemplate. How can this be a statement of the effect of the crucifixion of Jesus upon kings and nations? when virtually the kings and nations of the world today are not startled, are not astonished, have not been apprehended. In fact, it's a moot question whether even those nations that think themselves Christian have rightly understood and appropriated the Holocaust of Jesus. I think that God is going to set it before nations again. They're going to see the drama again enacted before their faces through a people who have become the least of his brethren. They're going to see the whole drama of being without any appearance that they should be desired, marred more than any man, rejected and despised. It will be a complete reenactment of the road to Calvary which Jesus himself trod. And not only will kings and nations be startled and understand what had been enacted 2,000 years ago and is yet available for their salvation now, but Israel itself will be startled and astonished. Their own experience, resembling that of the Lord before them, will give them pause to consider what they had 2,000 years ago rejected and keep rejecting until this day. For who has believed what we have heard, and to whom is the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of a dry ground, and he had no form of majesty that we should look at him. This sounds now like Israel in some future time looking back at that crucifixion of their servant, suffering servant Lord, whom they had rejected, and now in the light of the suffering through which they have passed, beginning to understand the mutuality of their experience and his. There was nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of suffering, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom others hide their faces. He was despised, and we held him of no account. This sounds very much like a future recognition that Israel will not come to unless it, in some measure, walks the same road to Calvary. Surely he has borne our infirmities and carried our diseases, yet we had accounted him stricken, struck down by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the punishment that made us whole, and by his bruises we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've all turned to our own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. This is a recognition to which Jewish people have not yet come. It's a recognition to which they will come. And I believe that the key to their coming to it is that they must, in some measure, experience his suffering, his rejection, be found despicable, unlovely, unwanted, acquainted with grief, and then understand that he fulfilled the same purposes for their salvation, and by it come to salvation. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Probably they will open their mouths. They'll grumble. They'll complain. They'll knock their fists at heaven. They'll wonder why it is that in the same century a second Holocaust. They'll not be silent, but they'll appreciate his silence and the fact that they themselves were unable to hold their own mouths. He'll stand out in remarkable contrast as the Lamb of God, which they themselves are not. He was cut off, it says, from the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. The word cut off is also to be found in Ezekiel 37. We are cut off. We are without hope. We are as dry bones. If you read that great prophetic chapter in Ezekiel, it's a statement of Israel's future, because that acknowledgement has never been historically made. Even the Nazi Holocaust did not bring an acknowledgement on the part of world Jewry. We are cut off. We are without hope. We are as dry bones. This experience that is coming, of which Jesus himself spoke, referred to also in Daniel, spoken also in Jeremiah, alluded to in Psalms, referred to by other of the prophets, is a future and concluding event in the prophetic salvation history of God. And it's going to be played out in all nations. And it will bring that people to a place where they will cry out, like the Lord, he was cut off, we are cut off, out of the land of the living. We are without hope, we are as dry bones. And when God hears that acknowledgement for which he's waiting, he's released to raise Israel from that death by sending a son of man to prophesy to those bones that they might live. Do you know who that son of man is? Who has the authority to speak for God, as God, with a creative word that can raise the dead? Because Paul says, what does it mean that Israel should be raised from the dead? It will be life for all nations. The issue of Israel's restoration from the death that is coming is the issue of life for all nations. But Israel itself must first be brought to life as the Lord was brought to life. It's the reenactment of the whole drama of which Jesus was the prototype. And the same power that raised him will raise them. It's the first resurrection of a nation, or at least a remnant of the nation, that will stand for the entire nation. But he himself does not speak the words of life. A son of man speaks it. You wonder why he didn't take the occasion himself. It's because that's our place. The Son of Man, in my opinion, is a picture of the church that has come of age in the last days, that has come to prophetic stature, that sees what God sees. Even reluctantly, it had to be brought out and down and into the midst of the bones. It has to have a faith to believe that those bones can live, and a faith that desires to see those bones live. If there's something rankling in the heart of that prophetic Son of Man that has not that desire, and he wants exclusively to be the object of God's whole devotion, it'll not be a word that will raise them. It has to be with an ultimate faith, with an ultimate agreement in God's desire to raise that people from its death. And it has to be a faith that works by love. See what the requirement is for us? It's a radical requirement and an ultimate requirement. And if we don't meet that, if we don't have any intention for it, no desire for it, are unwilling to be brought into it as the one people who can speak such a word in the moment that the Lord commands it, we will be eternally, what shall I say?
Embarrassed.
Huh?
Embarrassed.
Embarrassed. We will suffer an eternal grief for having fallen short of the glory of God and been satisfied with a modest Christianity that did not make such requirement upon us, for we did not desire it. We lived beneath God's intention and God's glory, and therefore we will have forfeited the reward that would have been commensurate with having come into the maturity and prophetic stature that would have constituted Israel's deliverance and salvation. So long as you're in Isaiah, take a look at Isaiah 35. My italic statement at the commencement of that chapter is the return of the redeemed to Zion. The wilderness and the dry land shall be glad, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom. The crocus shall blossom abundantly, rejoice and rejoice with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. Isn't it remarkable? God starts with nature. God starts with creation. What is happening that nature, dumb, insensate, unable to speak, can actually experience something and rejoice for something that is happening on its very soil? What makes it joyous? We're going to find out. It's a people being moved upon it and through it who are on a holy path to Zion. It is the highway of holiness through the nations, through the dry lands, through the grasslands, through the least inhabited places, the out-of-way places. The desert shall rejoice and blossom. And what an embarrassment for us, that dumb nature shall rejoice and we be glum? That nature should be moved and we be unmoved? For they shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Something's going to happen in that future time that reveals God's glory and God's majesty. For Israel itself must see God as God, for they do not know him as God, and require a revelation both of his majesty, his power, and his glory that shall be revealed and given to them on the highway of holiness in the backward, out-of-the-way places of the wilderness of nations. Have I prayed?
Yeah.
Then there's a break in the text, and God seems to be addressing someone that is not Israel itself. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are of a fearful heart, be strong, do not fear. Here is your God. He will come with vengeance. With great recompense, he will come and save you. This is not Israel speaking. This is something spoken to Israel, who is evidently so disconsolate, so broken, so dejected, so hopeless, that they are about to perish, except that a word comes to them in their wilderness place. The study of the Holocaust shows that men who were weaker survive, men who were physically stronger. Stronger men died while weaker ones survived, and the difference was that one had hope and the other was without hope. Hope is a remarkable life-sustaining virtue, but it needs to be imparted to a people who have been so reduced and so without hope that it must come to them from another who is somehow near them and with them in the place of their hopelessness, in the place of their wilderness, in the place where God has them move, and could say to them who are of a fearful heart, be strong and do not fear. Your God will come with vengeance, with recompense. He will come and save you. That has got to be more than just well-wishing. It's got to be more than just a nice, polite word, or it will fail. It has got to be a prophetic word. It's got to be a word that when they hear it, it's an event for them. Something happens, as is described here. For then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the speechless sing for joy. For water shall break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert, and burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground streams of water, etc. Dear saints, this is not poetry. This is literal, nuts and bolts, factual description of something that is yet future and must take place, or there will be no Jewish survival as this nation is uprooted and scattered again through the wilderness of the nations. Who will be there in that wilderness to speak these words that will constitute for a people who would otherwise perish hope that they will leap and the blind will see before the Lord comes to deliver and to save them, if it is not you? You see what God is after? He's after not only a nation that is restored out of death and sin and apostasy, but a church that is raised up to a maturity and use that it never would have sought nor attained, except that Israel required such a people to save them. Can you guys follow this? Are we in a condition today to speak like this? Do we know God so well as to say, your God will come? How do we know that? Because we have had a wilderness experience before them. We have been brought to a place of destitution. We have had our faith shaken. we have experienced a kind of hopelessness that God can produce even in the midst of our ordinary circumstances, in order that we should know Him and be able to convey the truth of Him who would otherwise perish unless someone could say with conviction, "Your God will come." Mere Sunday pew sitting will never attain this. 10,000 Sundays of proper religious Sunday attendance will never attain this. Something's going to have to be radically altered about the whole framework and knit of our present religious life, because it is not conducive. It does not lend itself to raising up a people of this kind of prophetic stature and authority. We may have to go again from house to house daily breaking bread. We may have to give God the opportunity to form this kind of character and this kind of faith in a quality of relationship and an intensity of life together that offends us. We like our privacy. We like a Christianity that is reduced to a Sunday service and a midweek Bible study. We think we're doing God exceptional service to come out on a Monday night. Can you understand? Israel is God's provision for the church, all the more and especially because she is in this despicable condition. There's a destiny for us as there's a destiny for her. And neither they nor we will attain to it independent of each other. We're in something together. And God has sent you a queer man, weeks, months, or years, I don't know when this will take place, I don't think it's too distant, to begin to sound to you those things that you need now to consider, that when they come, and it will be abruptly, when the bottom falls out with them, it will be with suddenness that you'll not be taken by surprise and find yourself altogether unprepared to be for them what you ought. It's too late then to take the challenge seriously. It needs now to be considered. Well, it says in verse 8, a highway shall be there, it shall be called the Holy Way. The unclean shall not travel on it. It shall be for God's people. No traveler, not even fool, shall go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. I think the ravenous beasts are not lions. They're men in a Nazi-like condition who, if they had the ability, would do again to Jews what they did 50 years before. God will not allow ravenous beasts to be upon this. This is a holy highway, and it's going to go through Zimbabwe. How do you know that, Art? Because I'm in Zimbabwe. It's going to go through South Africa because I've just come from South Africa. I've been in New Zealand, Australia, Japan, Philippines. It does not matter where I am. God says, I will sift you through all nations. Better to be prepared to anticipate them, and it should not take place, than it does take place and you find yourself unable to respond. If they are driven through nations by a relentless pursuit of a persecution that demands their annihilation, what will be the consequence to those who take them in and are caught doing so? Dum, 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 dum. This is not going to be some idle, casual hospitality. This is going to be something extended at great personal risk, as it was for Corrie ten Boom, and she was Dutch. In fact, Holland gives us more encouragement about a people who are willing to extend themselves at risk than perhaps any other European nation during the Hitler time. And they're going to have yet another shot at it. I'll be there in April speaking the same message. Who, what Gentile, however impressive a Christian, is going to extend themselves for a people in that condition when, if they're caught doing so, it means You know what Paul says in Romans 11? That by your mercy, they might obtain mercy. When have you ever extended mercy to a Jew? When has a Jew ever needed mercy until now? Have you a mercy to give? Deserve it. It's only mercy when it is extended to the undeserving. And will you be able to grant that? When they'll not be grateful, they'll not be thankful, they'll be insulting, and they'll probe you and find your what do they call it? Your button. Where something will rise up in indignation and anger and irritation that they have not only been ungrateful, but they have been insulting. Will you have the magnanimity and the grace to bear them when they are without any comeliness that we should desire them? Dear saints, this is ultimate. Mere sentiment will not suffice. Only one thing will serve in that day: the unconditional love of God. In a word, they're going to meet God through you, and not religiously oriented Christians who are under obligation to do something. Because it says in Ezekiel 20, I will meet with you in the wilderness of the nations face to face. That's how I got saved. Hey, I was an angry atheist. I was a vehement, bitter enemy of the church. I railed against it. I was not your casual atheist. God had to do a number on me, and he did it profoundly. In 14 months of being uprooted from California and cast out into the nations with a pack on my back for a 30-year-old man going on 35, that's a humiliation. For a professional man to be standing by the side of the road and watching cars whiz by while he stands in the rain and the drizzle is humiliation. Who would pick up an angry-looking object like that and take the risk? Those that did so were angels. They were like Gentiles of a kind I had never seen in Christian America. And they spoke to my heart and set me in the way to prepare me for the first reading of the New Testament. Never opened the Bible, old or new. University graduate. Typical Jew. Biblical illiterate. And in the very first reading, a revelation from God. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. I was devastated by a young American girl that I met on that trip. We just bumped into each other for the day. I should have had nothing to do with her. She was blonde, lily-white, freckle-faced, nut-nosed, Anglo-Saxon Protestant. The most deadly combination that a Jew can meet, coming from New York. But there was something about that little girl, half my age, that was so engaging. And she was just absolutely guileless and unafraid. And just spent an afternoon with me, walking in the woods around the Swiss city. And I'm probing this girl's motive. I'm an ex-Marxist. I embraced radical causes, but I'd never seen human kindness. In fact, we radicals could do in each other without batting an eyelash who are going to supposedly save the world. And so I'm asking her, hey, how come you've been kind to me? Oh, it's the love of God, she said. 5 minutes later, how come you're not afraid of me? Oh, it's the love of God. 10 minutes later, how come you're willing to spend time? It's the love of God. And this girl mentions God one more time, she's finished. My hobby is to engage Christians in debate and wipe them out. So it's this little girl to me. She mentioned God again. I said, listen, stop. I can't stand cliches. You know what a cliche is? Cliche is something that was once true and has lost its vitality as truth and has become a husk, a worn-out phrase that has lost its meaning and is still spoken as if it has meaning. You can do that with John 3:16. I didn't want to hear any more cliches. I had enough of those politically and ideologically to have to listen to them religiously. So I said, hey, I don't want to hear any more of that talk. Answer me one question that no Christian has ever successfully been able to answer. How do you know that God is? Gotta know. What is she going to think of? Some little clever thing she learned in Sunday school? I'll just rev up my great earth-moving thing, and I'll do her in. There'll be a long delay till she thinks of something clever. Right on the spot, she looked up at me, tilted that little Gentile face, beaming with the light of God, and said, Archie said, I know that God is. She lives in me. Boom. Down went the ox. Clubbed. Done in. Whacked. Devastated. Power. There was power in that little answer that sounds so much like a cliche. Who cannot say that? God lives in me. Who in fact is not saying it, for whom the evidence is not there. What made that girl's statement powerful? Enough to bring me down and to make me, when I finally recovered, to be jealous for the light that issued from that face, which I had never seen in universities or Marxist institutes, because it was true and she had the face to prove it. That's how I got saved, saints. And that's how a remnant of my people are going to get saved, so that Isaiah 35 will be fulfilled. The redeemed of the Lord shall return to Zion. They didn't leave it in that condition, but they shall return to it in that condition. Because in their road to Calvary, in their sifting through the nations, they're going to meet a people who will be glad for them, who will rejoice for them, who will be able to speak to them life-giving words, who know God and know that their God will come, because he's come for them. There's no greater demonstration, no more shattering demonstration for unbelieving Jews than to see the light that lightens the Gentiles and the glory of the God of Israel in the face of a Gentile. How you doing tonight? Dum-da-dum-dum. We are on a divine course. And because I have spoken these things tonight, you are without excuse. Don't say, nobody ever told me. I did not anticipate this. How could I have imagined that Bindura, Zimbabwe is appointed by God in this last day's apparatus of flight and refuge, that it would come through this remote corner of this earth, and that the earth will rejoice for them, and I myself am indifferent. You rejoice for them not because they are commendable, but because when the redeemed of the Lord return to Zion, the King comes, and the King rules out of that restored nation and out of its capital city and holy hill of Zion. Unless you like human rule better, or you think it could be improved. Maybe that's why you're not anticipating God's theocratic rule. Theo means God, cratic means rule. Democratic, the rule of people. Autocratic, the rule of a tyrant. I'm waiting for Theo. I'm waiting for God's rule. Because when he rules, it will be with perfect equity, justice, and righteousness in the earth.
Amen.
No man's land will be confiscated in that day.
Amen.
And no people who have been exploited and been taken advantage of will suffer that. He will rule with perfect equity and justice. Come, Lord Jesus. But there's no coming until their restoration. He's waiting for it, and you're the key to it. I know you didn't ask for it, but you're privileged. Because God has a better eternity for you than you yourself would have desired or sacrificed to obtain. Don't you know that this life is ephemeral and passing? That all of this is for preparation for that which is abiding, millennial and eternal? And that you're going to have a place in God's kingdom eternally in proportion to the quality of life and conduct and service rendered in this life? You want to get shut out? You want to be escorted to the basement? Or to the place of outer darkness with as much wailing and gnashing of teeth, which is not hell? That's not hell. It's an outer darkness away from the light, because you're not prepared and have not lived in its presence. You're making decisions now that will affect your eternity. So, Lord, is this the raw material, precious God? Is this it in Bindura? Is this what you have to work with? My faith, Lord, is weak, but you're a glorious God, and I'm inviting you to do a number on this people. Take them unsuspectingly and by surprise. And I'm asking, Lord, that whatever came from my mouth as we have been praying through the day was your word. You'll not allow it to fall to the ground. You'll not allow them to get away with any ability to dismiss it as being only the opinion of a man. Your authority, your presence in that word, the spirit of truth in that word will assuredly convince them this was God. And I'm asking, Lord, that that word would break in like that stone taken from the mountain without hands that breaks in to the kingdoms of this world and granulates them. This word will break in to those stodgy places of stubbornness and limited relationship with God and service that we have determined is okay and sufficient. It'll break in to that unspoken determination, this far and no further. It'll bring an apostolic and prophetic dimension of the awareness of the possibility for it in those who shrink from considering it because they know it's costly, because it requires sacrifice, because it's a suffering that they don't want to entertain. Lord, let something be transacted tonight that will have consequence in some soon coming day that will be life and death for a remnant of the household of Israel, because there were people here who expected them, who prepared for them, who rejoiced for them, and will reveal to them God's face, God's unconditional love, God's mercy, God's magnanimity, that they might be saved and return to Zion with singing. I bless them, Lord. I bless what is represented in this room. Let your holy seed fall into this earth and bear forth fruit. Work through the night hours, Lord, to rattle our box and bring whole new considerations as we have prayed all through this day into this people. Bring a light into our darkness, Lord. And if you're wanting us to see something about the condition of our hearts, that the issue of the Jew alone reveals, show it. Because the issue of the Jew in the last analysis is the issue of God. Not that they're godly, but they reveal the God who chooses. And our dispute with them is really our dispute with him. We don't like his choice. Lord, show us the subtlety of our own rebellion and self-will. Come, my God, have a people for your name that are called to divine history, that are called to last day's event, that they might have a distinguished eternity and not wail and gnash their teeth at having missed the occasion and the opportunity. I bless them, Lord. Only you can bring it to pass. In this humble beginning tonight, with this handful, that your word will not return to you void, but accomplish every purpose whereunto it is sent. In Jesus' name I ask it. Amen.